The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Tyra Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah. Bruce Willis's wife on how Hamilton reshaped her caregiving journey. 2 years after her husband's frontotemporal dementia, Emma Heming Willis had a revelation about love, loss, and legacy in the audience of the Broadway musical. Recently, Bruce and my oldest daughter, Mabel, wanted to take me on a mommy-daughter date to see the musical Hamilton. I thought, oh boy, a three-hour show? Evelyn, our youngest, ever her father's child, said, 3 hours? I'll sit this one out. You guys have some fun, flashing Bruce's signature smirk at me. Early in my relationship with Bruce, knowing I wasn't a big Broadway buff, he gave me permission to skip any show that ran longer than 90 minutes. He'd say, stick to the one XM. Still, there are things we'll happily do for our children. As Mabel and I settled into our seats, I exhaled, grateful for the simple fact that I could sit there for 3 hours, knowing Bruce was safe and cared for. I could rest easy. I muted my Apple Watch, silencing the alerts and reminders tied to our second home, allowing myself to be fully present with Mabel, who wanted this time with me. Not that long ago, moments like this were impossible. Oddly enough, I looked over and noticed another primary caregiver I follow on Instagram, sitting in the audience, too. She had recently lost her mother to Alzheimer's, and I couldn't help but wonder if she was slowly trying to reclaim parts of her life as well. Before becoming a caregiver, I took so much for granted: the ease of daily life, the spontaneity, and the freedom to fully immerse myself in the present. Now, as a navigator in this journey, I see that some color has been brought back to our world. The reframe has been in recognizing just how lucky the girls and I are to reclaim even small parts of our lives, not all of it, but enough. And those parts are met with so much joy, gratitude, and enthusiasm. Our lives will never be the same, and as much as I grieve this experience daily, as I know so many other caregivers do, I can also sit here and tell you we are better for it. Prior to seeing Hamilton, I wish someone had given me a heads up that I'd need more than water and a snack to get through the show. I'd also need one of Bruce's handkerchiefs because I bawled my eyes out more than once. Thankfully, the woman next to me was prepared and offered me a tissue as we wept together. A few songs hit me hard, but the one that sent me over the edge was "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story." The final song is a reflection on legacy, memory, and the impact a person's life can have long after they're gone. The song explores the idea that even great achievements and lives can fade unless someone actively steps up to preserve and share those stories. After Alexander Hamilton's death, his wife, Eliza, takes on the role of storyteller, dedicating herself to preserving his legacy, building institutions, and advocating for the causes he believed in. It made me think of caregivers. Could this be our theme song? We carry the stories of our loved ones, becoming their voices when they can no longer share their own. Just as Eliza Hamilton stepped forward to preserve Alexander's legacy, caregivers step into that space, ensuring that the essence of who our person was isn't erased or distilled down to just their disease. That line, "Who tells your story?" has echoed in my mind long after the curtain call. As caregivers, we don't just handle appointments. We don't just handle appointments, medications, and routines. We hold on to memories, safeguard our loved ones' dignity, and fiercely protect who they were before dementia. Bruce's story will continue. His legacy will live on through our family, his work in film and music, and the millions of lives he touched. But I believe he's leaving something even more profound, something that will ripple far beyond Hollywood. His journey is shaping the conversation around frontotemporal dementia, dementia more broadly, and caregiving, shifting the narrative in ways I hope will soften the experience for others walking this path. I know Bruce's legacy won't just be about the art he created. It will be about how he loved and how that love carries on through us. And as I sat in the theater with Mabel by my side, I realized I'm not just telling his story. Just like Eliza, I'm committed to continuing it. No matter where you are in this journey, know this, color will return. It may not look the same, but it will be beautiful in its own way. Applaud yourself for the work you're doing, one of the hardest jobs in the world. Your loved one would be proud, not just for the care you've given, but for the way you're honoring them by continuing to tell their story and for how you're choosing to show up for yourself. That was from The Unexpected Journey, Finding Strength, Hope, and Yourself on the Caregiving Path by Emma Heming Willis. Next, if you have ADHD, you're not a bad listener. Your brain is just loud. Here's how to tune into conversations. An ADHD coach shares 5 tips shaped by her journey and her work with thousands of adults. By Shauna Pearson. Have you ever found yourself in a conversation where, just as you finish saying something important, the person you're speaking to responds with a blank stare, followed by, mm-hmm, yeah, totally, before disconnecting from the conversation? That person obviously wasn't listening. Do you remember how you felt at that moment? Or worse, maybe you weren't listening and they flatly informed you, I literally just said that. Maybe you've been told repeatedly that you're not the best listener. If you have ADHD, chances are it's true. When others talk, you might initially be interested in what they're saying, but then a thought pops into your head. It could be something funny, something smart, or something that you need to share because you're sure you're going to forget it if you have to hold it in much longer. As soon as the other person pauses for breath, this brilliant and urgent response explodes out of you like soda from a shaken up bottle. When you have ADHD, it can be challenging to make sense of your own thoughts, let alone everyone else's. It's as if you are having a conversation with 2 people at the same time, the person you are speaking with and the thoughts that are running through your head. And there's a constant battle for your attention. And the conversation inside your head usually wins. To others, this can come across in many different ways. Do any of these examples sound familiar? Speaking in circles, oversharing and letting it all out, second-guessing yourself, interrupting and blurting out, missing what others are saying, being too intense, being overly confrontational, being overly sensitive, repeating yourself, trying for perfection. In your heart, you're truly interested in what people have to say, but in reality, it's really difficult to listen attentively when your mind is filling up with nonstop, very loud, and, admit it, extremely interesting chatter. Here are a few strategies to cut the noise for better communication. Set your intention. Think about why you want to communicate better in the specific situation or conversation you're about to have. Maybe you want to make a good impression, or you want to know more about another person and feel closer to them. By communicating well, you're connecting to a bigger, more meaningful goal. For example, when your son or daughter comes home from college for the holidays, you can repeat to yourself, my intention with this conversation is for my child to feel totally heard and loved by me. Alternatively, you can create an intention about how you want to be seen and heard with your family and friends or while you're at work. This works especially well if you find yourself interrupting people no matter who you're with. For example, my intention is to listen to what others say, be patient, take it slow, and allow others to express themselves before I jump in. Practice out loud. Preparing responses ahead of time and practicing them out loud can be very effective. For example, if you are often interrupted at work and don't want to snap at a coworker, you could practice saying, I'd love to talk about this, but I'm not able to right now. Can we discuss it later? You can use this in any situation when you might get emotional and impatient. If you think of 1 or 2 standard responses, write them down and then repeat them aloud. This is key. You will be able to respond in a way that is more aligned with who you genuinely are rather than lashing out in a moment of high stress and frustration. Park it. If you're an impulsive speaker, which many of us are, you probably say what's on your mind as soon as it pops into your head, even if it almost never works out well for you. Park your issue until later by writing down what you're thinking. This way, you eliminate the fear that you'll forget what you want to say while giving yourself time to regulate your emotions so that you don't say something you'll seriously regret. You can go back to it later, give it at least a night, and review what you've written, and then determine if it's essential that you share what you were thinking. Engage your brain. For women with ADHD, listening to someone who is speaking so slowly that it feels like watching paint dry is torture. Next time you feel distracted or catch yourself drifting off when you want to be paying attention, try one of these. Look for the speaker's purpose. What's motivating them to tell you this? Maybe they're trying to share something to feel respected, understood, or closer to you. Make mental notes. When you're talking with a friend or loved one, imagine there will be an exam at the end and try to take in every single thing being said as if you're going to be tested on it later. If something gets past you, ask them to repeat it. If you're in a meeting, write down the main points of what you're hearing. Another way to engage your brain is to physically move around. For some of us, sitting still and trying to maintain eye contact can be uncomfortable and distracting, and it's nearly impossible to pay attention to anything anyone's saying if we feel physically restless. In that case, walking or pacing while in conversation can actually keep you engaged and help you stay focused on the other person. Just be sure to let them know that you're pacing in order to listen better. Avoid the Olympic-level long jump to conclusions. Many of us unknowingly hijack conversations because we are certain that we know where the other person is heading, and it's not our fault it's taking them so long to get there. To keep from jumping to conclusions, purposely shift your focus to the other person. Slow down and verify that you've understood what they are saying. I think I get what you mean, or I hear what you're saying. And if you don't understand what they mean, ask a question to clarify. Sometimes asking a question about what you just heard is the best response to what someone is saying. It forces you to press pause on what your brain wants you to blurt out, shows the other person that you are interested, reaffirms that what they are saying is important to you, and may help you understand something you genuinely missed that you probably didn't even notice. That was an excerpt from Invisible ADHD, Proven Mood and Life Management for Smart Yet Scattered Women. Copyright 2025 by Shauna Pearson. Parkinson's cases are set to double by 2050. Here's what neurologists want you to know. The progressive neurodegenerative disorder already affects millions. This is by Corinne Miller. While a lot of new scientific studies are focused on better understanding and treating the most neurodegenerative disorder, Alzheimer's disease, diagnoses in the second most common one, Parkinson's disease, are steadily increasing. In fact, new research suggests that Parkinson's cases may actually double by 2050, which raises a lot of questions about why this might be happening and how you can lower your risk. It's important to be aware that there are still a lot of mysteries surrounding Parkinson's, a progressive nervous system disorder that makes it difficult to control movement in your body, including what causes the disease in the first place. But the latest scientific findings suggest that it's really important that we pay close attention to Parkinson's and focus on developing better diagnostics and therapeutics. Here's what the study found, plus what neurologists want you to know about lowering your risk profile. So what did this study find? In the study, which was published in the BMJ, researchers analyzed data from 195 countries and territories using the 2021 Global Burden of Disease Study. From there, they estimated how common Parkinson's disease is based on a slew of factors, including a person's age and sex, from 2022 to 2050. The researchers estimated that the number of people living with Parkinson's disease around the world would hit 25.2 million by 2050, which is a whopping 112% jump from 2021. By 2050, Parkinson's disease will have become a greater public health challenge for patients, their families, caregivers, communities, and society, the researchers wrote in their conclusion. Why are Parkinson's rates supposed to double? First, it's important to emphasize that these data points are just estimates. It's not an absolute guarantee that Parkinson's rates will double over time. However, the data currently suggests that it will. The researchers had a few theories about what could be behind this growth in cases, including the fact that the overall population will be aging while still growing. The condition is primarily a disease of late life, says Amit Sachdev, MS, MD, medical director in the Department of Neurology at Michigan State University. And as people get older, the risk of developing Parkinson's disease goes up. So it goes to reason that if there are more older people on the earth, the likelihood of increased Parkinson's cases also increases. Something else to consider, per Dr. Sachdev, doctors are getting better at properly detecting and diagnosing the condition, which can also cause rates to increase. Still, that doesn't completely explain the big jump. We know how Parkinson's disease happens, but we don't know what triggers the process, says Dr. Sachdev. What do these findings mean for caregivers? With higher rates of Parkinson's disease comes an even greater need for caregivers. People with Parkinson's require daily living assistance, mobility support, medication, management, and emotional care, according to Daniel Truong, MD, neurologist, and medical director of the Truong Neuroscience Institute at Memorial Care Orange Coast Medical Center in Fountain Valley, California, and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Parkinsonism and Related Disorders. The progressive nature of Parkinson's disease means that caregiving demands will intensify over time, contributing to longer hours and increased physical and emotional strain, he says. Caregivers may also need specialized training to help loved ones manage Parkinson's disease symptoms, per Dr. Truong, who adds that there will likely be a higher than ever increased risk of caregiver burnout. Caregivers may end up bogged down with the other responsibilities while trying to support parents or loved ones in their Parkinson's journey too. Folks are waiting longer to have their own children. Their parents are living longer, and diseases of slow progressive loss like Parkinson's disease are being managed but not cured, Dr. Sachdev says. This means people are living longer with these diseases, and caretakers are finding themselves supporting their older relatives and their younger children at the same time. What are Parkinson's risk factors? Remember, doctors don't really know what causes Parkinson's, but according to the Mayo Clinic, risk factors for Parkinson's disease can include being older. Symptoms usually start around age 50. Having one or more first-degree relatives with the condition. Being male. Being repeatedly exposed to toxins like herbicides and pesticides. How can I reduce my risk of getting Parkinson's? This is a little tricky, given that the exact cause of Parkinson's is not known. There is no known way to avoid Parkinson's disease, Dr. Sachdev says. However, there are ways to support healthier brains, which are more resilient and can support function longer. Dr. Truong recommends taking these steps to support your brain health. Get regular physical activity. Follow a Mediterranean or DASH diet. Try to avoid toxins and environmental exposures. Avoid head trauma. Keep your gut healthy by eating plenty of foods rich in probiotics and fiber. Try to manage stress. Get quality sleep. Stay mentally and socially active. Manage chronic conditions like diabetes, high cholesterol, and hypertension. Basically, taking care of your overall health can also protect your brain. While Parkinson's disease cannot be entirely prevented, a healthy lifestyle, avoiding toxins, regular exercise, and good sleep may significantly lower the risk, Dr. Truong says. These common phrases undermine your intelligence and authority. Here's what to say instead. Read this if you can't send an email without at least three exclamation points. If you've ever been too nervous to speak up in a work meeting or unfamiliar social setting, you've probably experienced imposter syndrome. And this is especially true if you have two X chromosomes. Turns out, some of that I don't belong feeling is systemic. Feminism hasn't taken us far enough to cut lingering biases against women, particularly women of color. So many environments still feel toxic and unwelcome, no matter your qualifications. But in other cases, women are getting in their own damn way, asserts Kate Mason, PhD, a champion debater turned communications expert and executive coach, and author of the new book, Powerfully Likeable. She's coined a term for this phenomenon, imposing syndrome. As in, we don't want to step on anyone's toes, get in anyone's way, or disagree with anyone. It happens when we're too aware of how likable we are, Mason tells Oprah Daily. We think, oh, they're going to hate me if I ask for more time or space. As Mason writes in her book, we hope that if we're good enough, thin enough, small enough, fast enough, cute enough, maybe that will be the path to success. Of course, it's good to be aware of how our actions affect others. Empathy, emotional intelligence, and all that. But focusing too much on how others perceive us undermines our own needs and feelings, says Mason. We make ourselves small by doing it. It makes us look unimportant. In her book, Mason identifies four strains of imposing syndrome. Here she explains why they sabotage your self-esteem and what to say instead. So this disclaimer, what it sounds like. I might be wrong, but, well, I'm not an expert, or I haven't had much time to think about that yet, or I'm sure you've already thought about this, but, and what to say instead? Wow, great question. I haven't had a chance to think about that. Let me come back to you. Or simply, my suggestion is, it's hard to resist giving a little caveat before sharing an opinion or suggestion when you're nervous about what people will think. When we make these comments, we sense a degree of impending judgment for an opinion or a feeling that our opinion might impose on the group to an unlikable degree, Mason writes. But a disclaimer is not necessary. In fact, it can backfire, make your audience question your authority. Even if you're not professor, doctor, expert, smarty pants, you should just cite the suggestion as what it is, a suggestion, Mason writes. We're not always going to be right, but that doesn't mean we should never speak at all. Next, the minimizer. What it sounds like. It'll just take 2 seconds. Can I pop by? And, oh, no worries if not. What to say instead? Hey, I'd love to talk to you about XYZ. When works? Or, I appreciate you helping me with this. When we know we're about to impose on someone's time or space, it's natural to want to make ourselves smaller. We think that someone is more likely to say yes to something if it's quick or non-intrusive. But this just makes our actual work and self seem less important. Or it makes it clear that the person is anxious, Mason says of the no worries if not pitfall. There are many worries, actually. If you're direct with someone, that fear of stepping on their toes will probably disappear. And they likely won't feel imposed on unless they're a jerk. The accidental underminer, what it sounds like. Does that make sense? What to say instead? Is everyone with me? Does that resonate for you? Are we all on the same page? Did anyone else feel that way? There's a good reason we use this phrase reflexively, says Mason. It's a bid for connection and consensus. But, she adds, this phrase ends up implying that you're a ditz, which you know is BS. It's often said by people who have made perfect sense. Or it's patronizing, like asking someone if their brain understood your big idea. It could even be just a space filler, because it's agonizing to finish a thought and be greeted with silence. Regardless, it never works in your favor. Try to imagine your most persuasive role role model, making a point, and then adding, does that make sense? At the end. Sounds weird, right? Mason writes, whether it's in a boardroom, meeting, or at your book club, you can still push forward in the discussion while giving yourself some credit and respecting others' intelligence. The serial down player. What it sounds like. I was just part of the team, despite being the boss. Well, I've been out of the workforce for a while, so I'm not a good person to ask, even though you started your own company. Or, I studied in Boston. We all know what that means. What to say instead? Thanks for letting me share my expertise. Or, that's so kind of you to ask me. I get it. It can be uncomfortable or seem boastful or honestly a bit weird to wander around with your credentials, Mason writes. And no one wants to be that person holding the dinner party hostage with tales of their latest achievements. But there's a difference between throwing around your accomplishments for no reason, bragging, and stating the facts. You don't have to be a world authority, Mason says. Just take credit for your hard work. And that article was by Casey Hurwitz. Okay, well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time. I'm Tyra Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black hole.